Mindy Hall's new book, Leading with Intention, Every Moment is a Choice, is available now. Learn more, download a free excerpt, and take the free Leading with Intention assessment at leadingwithintentionbook.com.
Welcome to Peak Development Radio, great conversations and practical advice for making your organization stronger. I'm your host, Dr. Mindy Hall, President and CEO of Peak Development Consulting. Today we're talking about business ethics and a new way of thinking about the topic. You know, business ethics often grab headlines when there has been a serious misstep, a product defect that is left uncorrected, a market that gets manipulated, or perhaps an executive who's misbehaved. When that happens, the media storm ensues and the ethical failings of organizations are highlighted. Companies start to scramble for ways to instill ethics in their employees to prevent bad behavior in the future. But a good question to ask is there a different way to think about ethics? Rather than employing them as a means to prevent negative consequences, what would happen if we instead focused on the positive effects of behaving ethically? Is there a dividend, financial or otherwise, that can be associated with behaving ethically? If so, how does it show up in our organizations, and what can leaders do to leverage it? My guest today, Eric McNulty, is the Director of Research and Professional Programs at the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative, a joint program of the Harvard School of Public Health and Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He also works as an independent consultant, teacher, and speaker. He has written articles for Harvard Business Review, Boston Business Journal, Market Watch, Strategy in Business, and more, and is the author of the forthcoming book, You're It, Mastering High-Stakes Leadership. Eric, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Mindy. I'm glad to be here.
You know, Eric, this idea of looking at ethics not through a negative lens of preventing bad behavior, but rather as a way of operating that can potentially produce a positive, tangible dividend, so to speak, is such an interesting way of thinking about it. What inspired you to think this way?
Well, there were a couple of things. I mean, I have done a lot of work in the past around leadership in the context of climate change and sustainability issues. And so there, it's where we looked at the green dividend of doing things that were made your business more efficient, may have saved some costs, may have generated more revenue, was the dividend for doing things in a green way. So that was a starting point, but that was just the beginning. I was approached by actually one of my academic advisors. I did a late in life master's program in leadership in the context of big societal, large societal problems. And he was chair of a conference and he said, we have a session scheduled called, Is There an Ethics Dividend? I'm not sure who could do it. Do you think you'd take a crack at it? And I said, sure, that sounds like fun. And so that's when I began to dig into this idea of the ethics dividend and look to see how could we conceive ethics differently, or was there guidance in the existing thousands of years old literature on ethics? And in fact, there was. And I think this notion of ethics guiding proactively how we behave in the world is how it was originally intended, and I think it's how we need to reimagine it now.
I think we all could say that, and most of the listeners would say, I know them when I see them in terms of ethics, but how do you define ethics?
Yeah, it's interesting because fewer and fewer of us have any formal ethics training. Certainly I didn't in my academic career. And as we've seen a decline in faith-based organizations, for example, participation there, fewer of us have a formal ethics framework of any kind. So it's a bit of ad hoc, what we've seen, what we've observed, what feels good to us. To me, I just think it's a set of values that guide your thinking, your decision-making, and your behavior. It's how you approach the world and how you judge whether you're doing something that's good or bad. Now, of course, the confusion there is there are many, many ethical frameworks to which one can subscribe, and as you can make one up of your own if you want, which where it becomes a little bit difficult in terms of assessing the impact of ethics across an entire society. I think we have less of a coherent societal ethical base than we once did, but still there seems to be an intense interest in behaving more ethically, particularly among millennials.
It's interesting. I was just reading an article about that in terms of millennials really saying, look, I'm fine doing work, but I really want to do work at a company that actually cares about the world at large. And really choosing companies that they're going to based not only on the job that they're going to, but, you know, what are the values and ethics of the organization? So it's really, I agree with you. Having just read that article, it's really showing up at least in that generation. I don't think it's exclusive to that generation, but I certainly see it showing up there.
Well, I think it's a really good point, Mindy. And I think that one of the things we're seeing with that younger generation is they weren't quite as indoctrinated in the notion that the sole purpose of a business is to make money, which came about in the 1970s, has had a good run of 30 or 40 years of being sort of a predominant way of thinking. They weren't nearly as baked into that. And you look back before the 1970s, before Milton Friedman wrote his famous articles claiming that the only social responsibility of a company was to make money, there was a greater consciousness of the social impact of business, thinking about customers, thinking about employees and other stakeholders. So this is not necessarily new. It's a return to perhaps what was. And I think this new generation really is, as you've mentioned, embracing it in a way that just fundamentally makes sense to them.
When we started, you said that you had dug into the research, right? You kind of came to this notion of an ethics dividend by a challenge from a professor and started to dig into the research. And you said it is possible to identify an ethics dividend, a positive benefit for the companies who display strong ethics. So what does your research say in terms of how it shows up in organizations?
Well, what came out of the research was a model that we'll talk about in a little bit, but it is solidly ethics-based. And so when I began to dig into the volumes of what's been written about ethics and ethical behavior, came across the notion from Aristotle, so going way, way back, that being useful is virtuous. And to me, that seemed particularly relevant to the business world because part of why you're in business is to do something useful. You should be in business is to do something useful. You're meeting a customer need. You're generating economic value. This is not a hobby. A business has a purpose. And if you are being useful, if you're meeting a customer need, you should be doing well in business. And so that was sort of my jumping off point. But further, there's other research that has shown, I was recently written up in Harvard Business Review, actually, that managers who openly and sincerely embrace ethics and values generate much higher levels of trust. And from those higher levels of trust come greater employee engagement. And I think there's, again, a significant base of research that shows when you've got engaged employees, you wind up with engaged customers.
And you actually, I mean, there's even further research that suggests when you have employees that are engaged, you then have higher financial returns on the business. Simply because if you go down that chain of they're serving customers better, happier customers, you know, make more loyal customers, et cetera, et cetera. So lots of connection points there.
Absolutely. And I think that's it's a way of approaching ethics that makes much more sense to business people than averting negative consequences of saying, okay, we'll avoid lawsuits. We will have more goodwill on the balance sheet, those kind of things, which don't seem to have been as effective perhaps as they might once have been. But this idea that companies spend lots and lots of money trying to engage customers and trying to engage employees. Simply embracing a strong ethical framework and living that framework, taking values off the value statement on the wall and actually putting them into practice, that can get you a positive outcome. Hey, that's a great thing to do.
You know, Eric, you just said something. I'd love to hear your perspective on it when you said taking those words off the wall and living them. And that to me seems to be where sometimes the gap occurs. Right, where you've got the writing on the wall of this is the way we'll behave, and then you watch the modeling that happens perhaps at the leadership level. You know, the number one way culture gets shaped is by what leaders model, right? And so, you know, if you're operating within this ethical framework, if there are ways that leaders are operating that aren't necessarily true to what's on that wall, what happens in an organization when that? I'm just curious your perspective on that.
Well, I think that people do watch what you do. I mean, it's one of the things we teach here at Harvard in terms of being a leader is that people are watching you, not just when you want them to watch you, but all the time. And they judge you by your actions, not by your words. And to me, the problem with a lot of value statements is that a team will go off for a retreat someplace in some, you know, beautiful bucolic setting and sit around all day and wordsmith a value statement. And they'll have good intentions and they'll come up with some wonderful things. But that's sort of where it stops. It comes back, they announce it, they put a plaque in the lobby. And for many companies, that's as far as it ever goes. What I think is really critical is to then take it the next step, which is to say, if these are our values, how does that show up in our practice? You can get it down right to the front line. So how do we greet a customer? How do we process an invoice? How do we onboard a new employee? How are our values reflected in activities like that? And when you get into that level of granularity, you can bake them in at a level that it's very hard to get them out. And so that the values will guide actual behavior. You know, some companies have done it, and you look back to the famous Tylenol scandal back in the 1980s, where the CEO not only withdrew product in the market where the poisonings had occurred, but it withdrew it nationwide. And when asked why he did that, he said, when I looked at our value statement, the first stakeholder we serve are customers. Shareholders are last on that list. And they have a list of five or six stakeholder groups. Customers come first. And so that told me this was the right thing to do. And so I think when you walk into the front door, when I walk in the front door, I can feel a company that really embraces and lives its values and others that just talk the talk.
So let's talk about companies where you do see ethical failings. It often seems to me like there's a greater tension between bottom line performance, and I'm going to describe that, you know, kind of in traditional performance measures, and responsibility to society. Is it possible to ever eliminate that tension, or is it more about organizations learning to manage it and kind of live with that tension?
I think it's really actually a fairly simple fix. I'd be interested in your perspective on this as well, which is we need to change the conversation from or to and. And often it's perceived as we can do good things for society or we can make money. If you think about we can do good things for society and we can make money, or we can make money and we can do good things for society, that completely changes the mindset. It can change the way you think about strategy. It changes everything. And just that simple switch from or to and. And we're seeing more and more of this kind of thinking. When you look at the work that Michael Porter and Mark Kramer have done around shared value, That's all about the and. The folks at the Center for Higher Ambition Leadership, who I do some work with, they're all about the and. They call it the simultaneous solve. How do you find something that works for all the stakeholders? That's an and.
Yep.
And when you do that, it really opens up many possibilities for how you innovate, how you handle customer service. Things that actually could open up lots of opportunities because you've shifted from maybe giving some money to charity is what we're going to do and it's a necessary cost of doing business to, no, we're going to frame the way we approach the world a little bit differently and see what that does for us.
I love that. I couldn't agree with you more. And I think for me, it moves it from being binary to being expansive.
Absolutely. And it gets one of the other themes I pursue in my research and my work is this notion of being a system-centric leader, of thinking about the larger system and society in which you operate, having that as your basic perspective on how you're doing things. And this, the and, it does open it up.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, you see that these other stakeholder groups have something to give you as well as get from you. And they're part of how you're going to grow the business.
So you've suggested that companies interested in pursuing an ethics dividend need to achieve clarity on three questions. And it's your purpose, values, and performance leadership framework. And so I'd like to dig into each one of those pillars, if you don't mind, and have you talk a little bit about each of them and how they connect together. So let's start with purpose. Describe that for us and what's involved in that from your perspective.
Sure. And this was the jumping off point, going from when Aristotle wrote that being useful is virtuous, to thinking about the purpose of why are you in business? Why have you invested money? Why have you hired people? Why have you launched a marketing campaign? Why are you doing this? And so I'm thinking of purpose not in the existential sense, although that's also important, but more in the Peter Drucker sense. And this gets back to the battle between sort of the Milton Friedman view of the world of the purpose of a business is to make money. Drucker said the purpose of a business is to create a customer. You know, it's about meeting a need in a way that helps a customer solve a problem. Also, Theodore Mann, who was a professor at Harvard Business School back in the 1970s, he framed it as asking yourself, what job is your customer hiring you to help them do? So getting beyond I'm selling you a product or I'm selling you a service, it's what job are you trying to get done and how can I help you do it in a better way? And if I'm able to do that, you'll reward me with economic value. You'll pay me for my product or service. Drucker, this has been attributed to Drucker, though I've never actually found the exact citation. Now, Drucker said that profit is to a business like breathing is to human beings. Necessary for survival, but not your primary reason for being.
Hmm.
So I think when a company goes deep on what is our purpose, why are we here, you'll get lots of interesting input from customers and suppliers and associates as to why you're really there. And it can ground you in being useful in the system. So I think a lot of times we look at unethical behavior, we look at manipulation of interest rates, we look at various things that go wrong that we see as ethical failings. They actually weren't very useful to the system. They may have generated short-term profit, but they really didn't serve a customer need. They really didn't make the world a better place or meet any people's more fundamental needs. It was about just twisting things around to make some profit in the short term. Bribing officials, all kinds of things that go wrong, aren't particularly useful, don't serve the purpose. So that's why we start there. And I think it's important to start there because everything else flows from that.
And so let's move to then the values piece, because this is where you start to dig in beyond just, I would say, being more internally focused, but also the and of externally focused.
Absolutely. And I think that you bring up a really interesting point there, because again, when companies put together a values statement, they often are very inwardly focused, and they'll go off on the retreat and craft this wonderfully sounding thing they can put in the annual report. But it's important to articulate the values and then see, are they aligned with the values of our stakeholders? You know, it's great that we want to be A, B, or C, but is that what our customers want us to be? Is that going to make our employees excited to get up and come to work every day? Is that going to make suppliers want to do business with us? Is that going to make regulators look at us and say, yeah, they're doing a good job, we don't need to worry about them? So I think you've got to look at values in that larger context. And then, as I mentioned earlier, really look at how they get applied in everyday practice. To say, if our values are to be fully trustworthy and to put customers first, what does that mean when we do activity A, B, and C? And really be open and honest about it. And I think the other thing that's important about getting values articulated, I mean, you don't have to talk about them every single day. It's more important to live them than to talk about them. I worked with a company that took a balanced scorecard approach. And so they had financial goals as one, and they had other three pieces of the typical balanced scorecard of customers and learning and things. But they framed it in a way that 50% of the score on the scorecard was always, at least 50% had to be based on the financial goal. And if you didn't make the financial goal, making the other three didn't ever matter in terms of a bonus payout. So there was somebody who took a balanced approach on paper, but in actuality, they were just saying all that counts is the money. So it's when you really bake it into practice and celebrate it, acknowledge it, that it really becomes real. So that's why it's so important to have this on the same plane with purpose and then performance.
And I think the secret sauce there is what you've articulated about it being not just the inward focus of the values you want to espouse in the organization, but the alignment with the network of people that you are doing business with.
I think you're right. And I think when you actually get into a conversation with your employees or your customers or others in the value chain about values, it can be a really interesting conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You can begin to form a bond with those players that you never would if you were doing a straight transaction. The values piece is really, really interesting. I'm glad to hear that resonated for you.
Well, and the last piece of your framework is around performance, which you've spoken and alluded to just a moment ago. But I want to talk about that a bit in terms of how you move past the traditional measures of performance. Primarily, I'm going to say stockholder return, and as you said in that example, it being all about the money, and how you move more into the interdependency of the purpose, values, and performance, so that performance isn't just this short-term focus. And we both know, particularly in Western business, the pool of short-term is so strong. So if you could just talk about the performance piece of your framework, and then the interdependency of those three in moving from something that isn't just about all the money.
Absolutely. I think what you've brought up is absolutely critical. And that's the reason performance comes last in this list. But I see these three as being on par. So if we were to put them on a PowerPoint slide, but in three circles, the circles would be the same size. And performance comes last for a couple of reasons. One is that, as you alluded to, we're really good at measuring performance, particularly financial performance. We typically have performance goals, we've got reports, we have meetings, we have indicators, we have all kinds of things around revenue and cost and the other typical financial indicators. We're not so good at measuring performance on values or purpose. And so I don't want to suggest that making money is bad or not important, because it is. I mean, a business has to make money to stay in business, but you need to attend to these other two. And part of that is often a performance problem doesn't require a performance solution. It requires a purpose or a value solution. So you mentioned earlier about the extensive research that has shown the financial benefits of having a very engaged workforce, because they do better with customers, they sell more product, all that, all the way down the line. So that's one where if you're seeing a performance shortfall, it's not about making the goal tougher or making the fine-tuning the key performance indicators, for example, or doing deeper analytics on the performance. and actually is getting your purpose and values right in a way that will engage your employees and engage your customers that will lead to better performance. I think we've got actually, we get to obsess over the performance piece and we've short-shrifted the other two. Mm-hmm. And I do, and you mentioned again that it was, these are interdependent. I absolutely see these as part of a larger system and a larger way of, sort of a holistic way of thinking, because it is not having your values straight that will lead you astray and will lead to performance failures. You know, when a large financial institution not long ago had to pay a $20 billion fine for some bad behavior. Now, I can't think of a shareholder on the planet who's going to think a $20 billion fine was a good use of their money.
Exactly.
Right. You should have been able to do better, more productive things with that money by serving customers, by finding innovative new ways to do things, paying big fines. And you go across the board and you look at the penalties. And again, you mentioned the short term, which I think is, again, such a critical piece. There is so much pressure on short term returns. Some public companies have gotten good about it and say, you know what, we're not going to issue quarterly guidance. We're just not going to do it. It shouldn't drive behavior that way. We also forget a bit that there's a relatively small number of public companies. The number of private companies is magnitudes larger. You know, I'm sure in your client base, you look at it and say, there's actually lots of privately held companies who don't have to worry about the short term quite as much. And they may follow the pattern and sort of obsess quarter by quarter, but they don't need to. They can take a longer view, and there are sometimes you need to invest this quarter so you'll do better at the end of the year or next year. And those are the things you've got to be thinking about. And I do think, again, because of the growth of some of this work around higher ambition and shared value and conscious capitalism, it's beginning to get some traction in the public conversation. That's beginning to shape people's behavior a different way and say, you know, we've got to think longer term than this.
Eric, I'm sure there are companies in your research and in your work that you see who are doing this well. So what sets them apart?
Well, I think a couple of things. And I like to look at particularly unsexy companies, because I think it's really easy to look at, you know, Patagonia has a great reputation and they're trying to make more by selling less. Unilever is Paul Polman, the CEO there, said he wants to cut their carbon, their environmental impact in half, but sell twice as much stuff. When companies like that are highly visible, you can say, well, they get some PR spin out of it and it's good to look good. I find the examples where you get these businesses that are, you know, intellectually can be quite interesting, but they're just fundamentally unsexy. And one of the ones I've worked with and I like a lot is Premier Farnell. And they're a UK-based company. They're in electronic parts distribution. They operate in about 120 countries, I believe, when last I looked. So they're a large global company. They're on the FTSE 250, but they ship electronic parts around the world. And it's about getting small quantities of specialized parts to design engineers very quickly. And they were in a turnaround situation a few years back. I worked with the CEO, Harriet Green, she's since moved on, but she was CEO at the time. She came in to do the turnaround. And one of the things she made fundamental to that turnaround was what she called the trust agenda. And they set out that they were going to be the most trustworthy partner possible to each of their stakeholders. Mm. And that trust, this trustworthiness was going to drive how they thought about things and what they did. And what they found was it greatly expanded their thinking in how they engaged with their customers, how they engaged with the suppliers they bought from, because they're an intermediary. And it really gave them, and Harriet said, you know, it sort of gave people a cause. It gave them more than just a nice mission statement or, hey, we've got to turn this place around. It gave them something they could really believe in and feel good about, this idea of being trustworthy. But what it also did was it led them to do things like, for example, they created an online community for design engineers, because a lot of their customers were one and two person operations, you know, in a garage somewhere trying to come up with the next smartphone or the next high-tech prosthetic device or things. You know, they're doing a lot of prototyping, and these were people who did a lot of working by themselves and they didn't have a great opportunity to connect with other people doing similar work. Hmm. They created this online community, and it was an open community. They, you know, they sponsored it and hosted it, but they didn't censor it. You could go in and say Premier Farnell was the worst company on earth if you wanted to, and they wouldn't take that down. But they created this forum to connect customers to each other. And they found they had tremendous benefits. First of all, they learned a lot more about what their customers were doing. They did build this trust, so they became the preferred source to go to for the components. And they found new ways. They began offering use of software, design software to help people do prototyping more easily. And it quickly gave got them an inventory of the parts they were going to need. And so they found new ways to serve their customers. And it all started from this idea of being trustworthy and what could we do to be more trustworthy, more trusted by each one of our stakeholders. Another company here in the U.S. is Cascade Engineering. They're based up in central Michigan, and they make a lot of plastic things like the panels on the inside of the doors of your car. So again, not a business people are going to be go ooh and ah about. But they've been very successful. They manufacture here and a bit overseas. They've done tremendously interesting things around welfare-to-work programs, prison-to-work programs, because they needed the workforce to be able to manufacture and compete in the global economy. And they found they couldn't just go knock on the door of the local university and get everybody. They needed to look at the total labor pool and say, what are the resources here? How can we bring them in a way that works for us and works for them? And so they've done some really, really interesting things. It's become becoming a bit of a national model. It's become certainly a regional model. They're working regionally with other companies like Herman Miller and sort of a mini manufacturing hub up in central Michigan. For how do you find these people who are a bit at risk, may not have all the skills you need, may need some social support? How can we engage them in a way that they become great workers for us? And when they're great workers for us, they're going to become, you know, breadwinners for the family. They're going to become valuable members of the community. They're going to have lots of positive outcomes. So they've, again, they've brought it together in this notion of a simultaneous solve to say where we go. So those are two companies that come to mind. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. You had a...
No. Those are terrific. I think I love the last example. You just think of the systemic impact of that, you know, and you referenced it to families and communities, and it's wonderful. It's just wonderful. I love the examples.
And I think one of the things we shouldn't skip here is that, and Cascade Engineering reminded me of it, is that, you know, in not quite half the states, I believe, occurring, you can actually become what's known as a public benefit corporation as part of your incorporation, your governance. And there is very explicitly says, we are going to take into account a social mission beyond simply returns to shareholders. Mm. So anybody who invests in the company at that point knows that's what your mission is. Elo, which is the sort of emerging hot new social network, we'll see if it actually ever becomes a reality, but the hype is pretty high right now. They became a public benefit corporation with their most recent round of funding. They're trying to challenge Facebook and become a next hot thing. And if you're not in a state that does this public benefit corporation status, you can still, the group called the B Labs has an assessment that any business can take to become certified as a B Corp in terms of your practice. And it's a great guideline to say, to be able to figure out what is your impact, how can you improve your impact, how can you think about things in a way that are socially beneficial as well as profit making.
Terrific. And where would somebody find that?
If you just Google B Lab, okay, it'll pop right up. Or I think it's bcorporation.net. I may be wrong on that, but if you Google B Corp or B Lab, it will pop right up.
Okay, great. So, Eric, one of the things I want to close with one question that I ask all of my guests, and it's taking the great conversation and boiling it down to two or three practical tips that we can leave people with. So as you think about two or three practical tips that you could offer companies in terms of making your leadership framework come to life, that framework of purpose, values, performance, where should they start, or what would you want to leave them with in terms of two or three practical tips?
I hope that the purpose, values, performance framework is in itself practical. And that's one of the reasons I put it together, was to help make some of this more theoretical work around bringing together profitability and social good into a framework that's useful. So I hope that's useful. Mm-hmm. But as you use it, the first thing I would say is listen. Listen to all of your stakeholders. Listen to what they're telling you. You start with the basic proposition that no one has all of the answer, but everyone has part of the answer. It'll put you into listening mode, and you will learn amazing things that can help you grow your business as well as improve your ethical performance. So listen. That's good in every aspect of life, by the way. Just listen more. You're always better off. Second is use the power of narrative. When you get into purpose, values, or performance, construct an actual narrative. As I mentioned, you can take this down to the front lines and write a short story. A fully trustworthy bank is, and start writing out how you behave, what you do, all the aspects of it. Tell that story. It'll make it very real for people, and it'll make it possible to see how it can have a daily impact on how you do business. Mm. And if you're doing things well, tell those stories. When those stories become part of your sort of corporate mythology, become part of who you are, it gets passed as new people come into the organization. They hear those stories. They get how you do things. You maintain that clarity. We mentioned clarity briefly earlier. Clarity is really tough to maintain because we're in the world is changing. People come and go from organizations. Your customers change. Your competitors do different things. So maintaining that clarity, stories and narrative are a great way to do that. If you pass them down, it'll help improve the culture and enhance the culture over time. And then finally, be the change. Be the change you want to see in the world. That was Gandhi, and it's so true. And we shouldn't simply say, oh, that's the way it's always done, or the governance structure says only think about shareholders, that's how we're going to do it. No, there are plenty of companies who have found ways to be the change. You need to join them and just get over that barrier of you can't do it. You can do it. It just takes a first step.
Eric, what a pleasure to speak with you today. I have thoroughly enjoyed this time. So thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. And I'm glad you're out doing good work in the world as well. So I look forward to continuing the conversation.
Absolutely. Again, that's Eric McNulty, Director of Research and Professional Programs at the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative and author of the forthcoming book, You're It, Mastering High Stakes Leadership. I'm Mindy Hall, President and CEO of Peak Development Consulting, and this is Peak Development Radio. We're on the web at peakdevelopment.com, where you'll find white papers, our blog, our article review service, and links to our Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn profiles. Subscribe to this podcast through iTunes or Stitcher.com for access to future episodes. And don't forget to download shows to listen on your computer, your phone, or even on your commute. We always like to hear from you, so please take a moment to give us a rating or review on iTunes. And remember that good ideas are worth sharing, so if you found today's conversation to be useful, please feel free to pass it along. My new book, Leading with Intention, Every Moment is a Choice, is on sale now on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, 800-CEO-READ, and more. It's packed with practical tips and lessons for being more deliberate about the impact you want to have in both your leadership and your life. For more information and to take the Leading with Intention assessment, visit leadingwithintentionbook.com. Join us again at Peak Development Radio for great conversations and practical advice on making your organization stronger.